Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are women and their children the primary casualties of modern warfare? And what do they need to rebuild their lives in the wake of extreme violence and destruction? While we may think first of soldiers when we picture the horrors of war, 90% of the people hurt are actually civilians. 75% of those victims are women and children. Women are also the first to be displaced by war and often lead the way back into ravaged communities to try and rebuild. Few people understand better how those women struggle and what they need to survive and thrive than Zainab Salbi. She escaped a life and an identity as the daughter of Saddam Hussein's private pilot to move to the U.S. and later found the not-for-profit advocacy and aid group Women for Women International. Her books include The Other Side of War and the 2005 memoir Between Two Worlds. She's in town to address the Global Outreach Forum and accept the Austin College Posey Leadership Award tomorrow night at the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas. Zainab, welcome to Think.
Pleasure. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Reading through your book, it becomes clear that in many cases, women are like the canary in the coal mine when it comes to conflict. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Very much. I call women the bellwether for the direction of a society. Mm-hmm. Violence, as a matter of fact, often starts with women, and progress often starts with women. If we look at Afghanistan as an example, the first acts of violence that the Taliban committed when they first took over the country was against women. And the rest of the world and Afghans themselves said, oh, it's just women, you know, and we all, in truth, we said it's just women. Well, eventually, and this is according to Afghan man, eventually that violence spread to men. I was in Afghanistan recently, and one man told me, he said, first we thought it's just the women and they cover their head and they have to be hidden in their rooms and their windows were painted. But eventually they told us we too have to grow our beard and we too cannot shave anymore. And eventually it hit the children as well. And eventually it hit America and it changed the world. And so I actually think of women as the bellwether and an indicator for the direction of the society. And rather than looking at women's issues and what happens to them in conflict as just a marginal discussion, we need to look at them as a central discussion. What are they telling us about that nation? And how can they lead us actually in our political thinking in that nation?
Why is it that when it happens to just women, people are able to sort of turn a blind eye or say it's not that bad? Is it because we assume that violence against women is something that happens within the home or within small group settings as opposed to something that is sort of placed by a larger entity?
Well, there's a Talmudic saying we see things as we are, we do not see things as they are. If you look at war, for example, we often understand war only from a frontline discussion. Yeah. We understand it from the troops and the soldiers and the bullets and the weapons and things like that. And frankly, that's mostly what our media talks about, you know, in the front pages. Now, having grown up in war, in the Iran-Iraq war, and working in war with Women for Women International, very early on, you understand that there is a backline discussion of war. And that discussion is led by women, just as the frontline discussion is led by men. So the backline discussion, it becomes about how do you live life in the middle of the war? How do you deal with the violence? How do you deal with the displacement? How do you deal with this, keeping the kids going to school or the food going, you know, and being served in your kitchen table? But that is not seen. The value of that or that reality is not seen by the leaders or men in general who are leading the frontline discussion. You know, it's so we see it only from one aspect of it, one side of the coin, and we're not seeing it from the other side of the coin. Now, the consequences of that is if we understand war only from a male perspective and not from a female perspective, then we're also understanding peace and going about it in the same way. In other words, peace becomes about the ending of fighting rather than the building of actual peace and the sustainability of life and prosperity, you know, the backline discussion. And so it is time for me, to see things as they are, not only to see things as we are. And as they are has a lot to do with the woman's story.
So let's talk about that. If the end of bullets flying is just the beginning of sort of forging a peace, what are the first and most important things we need to do in order to empower people who in some cases go back to homes that are rubble if they exist at all, or if they can even get back to the places they come from?
Very good question. I actually just came from Congo, and one of the things that I kept on asking, and I always ask in my trips, is what are the things that you need? What are your hopes? What are your aspirations? And my consistent observation is that survivors of wars, people whose life has been shattered overnight because a bomb fell on their home or rebels attacked their homes, they actually are very eager to rebuild their lives. Mm-hmm. Their agency is active. I want to go back and I want to have my home, no matter how poor or rich they were, actually. It's irrelevant. And so how do we treat that is the question. So often we respond to war in a humanitarian aid as a mentality, which I'm not denying is needed. So we say about food distribution and clothing distribution and all of these things. And while this is needed on the short term, it is rarely captured. We really captured the agency of the people who are impacted, mm-hmm. in which, thank you for the food, but I really need to eat my food. And thanks for your secondhand clothing, but I really need to earn my own living so I can pay for my own children. Once a woman in Bosnia, and this was a while ago when the war was in the midst of the war in Bosnia, right after that, actually, she said that she really wanted to, you know, come in and not receive charity. She wanted to get a job. She wanted to earn a living. And when I asked her why, and she said, well, my teenage son wants a pair of jeans, mm-hmm. and we are sleeping on cardboards. And all humanitarian agencies, they want to give me perhaps food, maybe some medicine, maybe some clothes, or you know, or bed. But what I want as a mother is to get my son his pair of jeans, so he would not become a thief. She was afraid that he would become a thief, mm-hmm. if she doesn't get it. So it's at the end of the days, how do we capture people's agency and really integrity and dignity for them to want to be simply a good mother to provide for my child what he needs in this case?
One thing, Seynab, that really stuck with me is, you know, in this country, from the relative safety of this country, and based on the kind of media reports, the impersonal in some cases that we receive, we can sort of think of people in war-torn regions as other kinds of people somehow. And you described traveling with a woman who had been reduced to begging for food and for a little bit of money. And she looked at you and said, you know, I used to have a house. Like, and it really struck me that it's so easy to think, well, these people have always dealt with this and that's sort of very sad, but that's their lot. But they're not so different than people anywhere else.
Not at all. Literally last week I was in Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and I was interviewing a woman. And even I slipped into that. I was asking her about her past and what happened to her, and she was telling me about how she got raped and her husband was beaten and the rebels pillaged everything she owned and they burned their home and she went to poverty. And all this time I'm thinking that she's a poor person. Mm-hmm. And then she had to correct me in the middle of my interview, and she says, I was a rich person. I had 5 cows, 10 sheep, and which is wealth, by the way. That, you know, you have to, you know, we measure wealth in different ways. She was a wealthy person in her community. And she said, I wasn't always poor. The war made me poor, you know, but you have to understand, I was a wealthy person in here in every standard. And, you know, I captured her dignity. You know, it was a moment of dignity. Don't look at me the way you want to look at me. As a victim, mm-hmm. I was actually a strong woman and an independent woman. Now, her story is a great story in which she practically rebuilt her life. And she's now, again, the cow owners and the cow's owner, rather, and the sheep and the herds that she has. And that's the amazing part of the story. And so it's almost how we look at people in their fullness. You know, no one is one identity. No one is only a victim or only so. Everyone has multiple identities. In my interviews last week, you know, I talked with a woman who was a sex slave. But what really made her happy and she giggled and talked is when she talked about her love of her husband and the first time she fell in love. And it is that connection. At the end of the day, we have similar stories. Mm-hmm. And I actually really believe at the end of the day, we have similar access to the same consciousness, same knowledge. That is not necessarily based on going to school or education, but it's the human knowledge, if I may call it. And we are all really the same in our journeys. It just happens that, and you never know when it happens, you know, that your life is destroyed over a nanosecond for reasons you often have nothing to do with it as a civilian.
Talk about this. One of the first places that you worked was the former Yugoslavia, and one of the tactics of war there were these rape camps were set up specifically for that purpose. It wasn't that women were put in these camps and then they were often raped. They were put there to be raped.
Well, women are often, actually almost consistently throughout historical wars, have been targeted for rape and violence. The only difference is that in the former Yugoslavia, there was a switch in which women start talking. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, in just the last century's war, it is estimated that 900,000 German women were raped by Russian soldiers in World War II. As a matter of fact, Stalin wrote in brochures for Russian soldiers to encourage the soldiers to rape the women and break their Germanic honor, as quote unquote, as he put it in the brochures. There, in 1971, it's estimated that 400,000 Bangladeshi women were raped by Pakistani soldiers in the independence war for Bangladesh. That has always been consistent. The only difference is that in the past, women went silent and did not speak. And because we carry too much baggage of honor and culture and, you know, our family's honor and our people's honor and all of these things. The difference in Bosnia is that women were speaking out. So in Bosnia, women were given numbers, actually. There were organized rape camps. When the numbers were called, they had to go to the second room and get gang raped from a period from a month to 9 months. Every single day, they had to cook and clean for the soldiers, and often they were asked to do that naked.
And the idea, by the way, was deliberately to impregnate these women.
Raped women generally are rarely killed. They are usually always released, as a matter of fact. One, sometimes they are mutilated. Their breasts are cut or their bodies, they're left facial scars.
Yeah.
But they are rarely, rarely killed. When they are killed, it's usually one woman, and it's usually done in a very symbolic way in public and in front of the whole community. And that is sort of to leave a message from, you know, if I may, from one man from one side to the other man from one side. So
it's like a woman's an object in the middle.
Women are totally seen as an object. It's a message from one man to another man. And as we enter the land and invade the land, we are also taking the women and we're sending them back to you with impregnated with our own genes, with our own seed. So it's a very much tailored. It's tailored for different reasons. One is to sort of deconstruct the enemy society, the other side society, you know, to because mostly families abandoned the raped woman. In Bosnia, you know, it was a pattern of change, actually, in which women were saying, or actually religious clerks and political politicians as well, said, we need to treat raped women just like any soldier who comes injured from the front line. These women are just simply injured. So there was a switch in how the society treated the women. And it's not perfect, and there are lots of issues, but there's still switch. But otherwise, it's used to deconstruct the other side, if you may. It's also used to service the soldiers, usually in the comfort camps in the Japan run in World War II or in the Bosnia camps. It is the first time often for soldiers to have sex. You know, this is to as a comfort for the soldiers. And then it is also in Rwanda, where I, again, was just there last week, where they were in the radios, the Interahamwe, encouraging extremist Hutus to rape Tutsi women, and saying that rape them and they're dirty and break their honors and all of these things. So it is one way of attacking the enemy through the bodies of women. And it's historical been the case. And as we speak now, hundreds of thousands of Congolese women, as we speak now, are getting raped. In my last week's interviews, I was meeting with women who got raped last week, last month, 2 months ago. This is still happening, and we are still not outraged, or, you know, if you don't want to use the word outrage, we're not awakened into the fact that this injustice cannot continue in this day.
Zainab Salbi is my guest. She's the founder of the not-for-profit Women for Women International and author of books including Between Two Worlds and The Other Side of War. She's in town to address the Global Outreach Forum and accept the Austin College Posey Leadership Award tomorrow night at the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas. You can join our conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Zainab Salbi. She is founder of the not-for-profit Women for Women International and author of Between Two Worlds and the Other Side of War. She's in town to address the Global Outreach Forum and accept the Austin College Posey Leadership Award at the AT&T Performing Arts Center tomorrow night. You can find more information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So you go around the world to people in these different war-torn countries that you're trying to help, and you ask them what they need. What do they say?
At the end of the day, they all say the same thing. They want jobs, really, no different than us in here, right? They want jobs, they want education, they want better future for their kids. And that's the premise of Women for Women International's program. So every single woman in our program is grouped with the 25 other women in a classrooms of women, if you may. Mm-hmm. She goes through an educational program that basically teaches her about her rights, her health, her political rights, her educational rights, all of that, teaches her about the access to services and the legal rights she has. That's one track of training. The other track is that we do vocational and business skills. Try to study what the local market is asking for and tailor skills that will enable her to get a job. So 1 year, she goes through an educational program, vocational and business skills program. She graduates and we help her place her in an income generating opportunities. And to give you an example, women are 70 to 80% of small farmers in the world. They produce 60% of the world's food, 90% of the most staple food, maize, rice, things like that. Yet they earn 10% of the income and they own less than 2% of the land. Hmm. And so one of the things that we do at Women for Women is her vocational skill is actually organic farming. We then lease lands from the government, distribute it in the form of co-ops to women participants in our program, and then find commercial buyers for them for their produce. And this way the women are having food sustainability as well as earning double the income before they entered. I was just looking at some of our data. Sometimes they enter earning 30 cents a day. And by the time they leave, they earn nearly $1.5 a day, which is above the poverty rates or around that rate. So this is, the gist of our program is how do we help a woman move from victim to survivor to active citizen? And we do that because every single woman around the world, and particularly in America, is part of this. So we do that by asking every woman to sponsor one woman at a time by sending her $27 a month and exchange pictures and letters with her for 1 year only. And that sponsorship enables the participant, the recipient, to go through this training program that I just described and help her graduate to a place where she's standing up on her feet and she's earning her own income. So everyone is part of it. I am part of it. You are part of it. Every woman is part of the Women for Women model, if you may.
What happens when you tell people about their rights and they say, that's all well and good, but it doesn't happen here?
They rarely say that, actually.
Really? So they automatically believe that it's going to happen?
No, it takes a lot of work. But that's why you do it in a group setting. Mm-hmm. But to give you an example, one woman in Congo learned that her husband, that she had her inheritance right, and that her in-laws cheated her out of an inheritance. And the only thing that she did is she did not know about her legal rights. So sort of saying, rather than it's impossible, I cannot get my land or my home back, she actually collected that money that we distributed to her, hired a lawyer, sued her parents, her parents-in-law's, 20 years, rather, after the husband's death. Mm-hmm. And she got the house back.
Wow.
Some of it is more my ownership of my knowledge. Do mm-hmm. I know that? Another woman in Afghanistan I met, and I was shocked when I met her. She lifted her burqa. Her face was full of tattoos. And in Afghanistan, tattoos are called the makeup of the poor. Mm-hmm. So it's facial tattoos. It's beautiful. And she said, you know what? My husband slapped me and beat me almost all our marriage life. And I never once questioned him. I thought this is his right, and he thought this is his right. And we repeated what his father did to his mother, and I repeated what my mother always received. So it was just no one questioned it. And she said, for the first time, I realized it's not in his right. And it's not in my right to accept it. You know, this is just not in his right. So I went home. He tried to slap me and I held his hand and I said, talk to me in a different way. And in her case, I was shocked. I mean, when she was telling me that, I was absolutely shocked. And I said, what happened? She said he was so shocked that he stopped and he sat talking. And in her case, her marriage actually improved. But it took her to own her voice, to remember her values. You see, I really think that for change to happen is not only about the other side and how this other side outside of us can change. It is mostly how we can change. Now, sometimes we find resistance. There are other women who got divorced, for example. But often when we stand up for our voice and our rights, I really believe we actually get what we want. When I wrote my memoir, I was petrified. I was horrified that if anybody knew that I knew Saddam Hussein, that I called him uncle, though he's not my relative, but just my father's, you know, friend, that they will stop seeing me for who I am and they will see him instead of me. And I was mostly afraid of Iraqis in Iraq. And when I wrote my book and it was released in different parts of the world, and definitely the word came out in Iraq, the very people that I was afraid of, they called me and said, good for you for breaking your silence. We all associate with you. And so I often think that we own our fear and that ownership does not enable us to change. And all what we're doing is, I call it an awakening process, is know that this is your right. And if you choose to do something about it, it's your right. And if you choose not to do something about it, it's your choice. You know, it's really respecting that, but making knowledge available for her.
Let's talk a little bit about your background, because your parents were not really politically active people at all. They were had been educated and wanted to have a good life for you and traveled around the country. And so how did your father come to be in the employ of Saddam Hussein?
out of no choice whatsoever. My parents indeed are very apolitical and want nothing to be in politics. And until today, when you talk to my father, he says, I just want to fly a plane. I never want to be any president's pilot or any, you know, any association with any political figures. But that made him a very good candidate.
Yeah.
He's a safe friend. Mm-hmm. He has no political ambition. He has no political desire. So it's actually what made my parents very good candidates for friendship with Saddam Hussein. But they resisted that for about 2 years. And it took a moment. And that moment I always think about. And sometimes we often are faced in that moment, albeit not with Saddam Hussein. But it was a moment in which, after 2 years of resisting his friendship and not accepting his invitations and things like that, they went to visit a friend. You know, without, you know, just knocked on their friend's door. Back home, we don't necessarily call and have advance appointments. We just stop in. And the friend opened the door and he said, Saddam Hussein is in the living room. And my parents always talk about that moment. It was their life-changing moment. Mm-hmm. And they talk about how they knew that if they entered the home, that would be a friendship, the beginning of a friendship that they will not be able to get out of. Or the getting out of it is either by being killed or he's mad at you or you stay in it, you know, because he killed his own best friends. And if they had left and turned their face, it would be a big insult and it still could lead to the end of their lives. And so they made the choice to enter. And that was the beginning of what started as a social friendship. They were basically part of the elite of Iraq, if you may, of Baghdad, you know, and he wanted to know more about Western music from them and English and etiquettes of eating etiquettes and things like that than their own political views. And it ended up with a profession of my dad where he asked him to be his own private commercial pilot. And it ended up a relationship not only between my dad and him, but the whole family was sort of reported to the friendship. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a time where we were asked to go to a farmhouse every single weekend. I had no friends. I was not. We were basically the jester in his palace, if you may. Whenever he wanted us, the whole family beyond my father had to report. And the rules were to smile when he smiled and to cry when he cried. And that's how we survived. It was in a way, he was like a poison gas leaked into our home, and we breathed him slowly, and we resisted him slowly, and we died slowly, and my mother physically died, actually. Mm-hmm. And I do not want to deny the privileges that came with it. It came with lots of material privileges, the cars and jewelry and all of these things, and it came with fear, because being close to him did not mean that we were safe from danger. Actually, he again killed his lovers, his friends, his own relatives. It meant that we were constantly captured by that fear. And as a teenager, I grew up witnessing that and seeing my parents struggling with that. And realizing only many years later that acts of courage in their case did not happen in the big heroic Hollywood movies kind of way. That acts of courage in most normal people's case is actually small steps. And my parents took a lot of small steps that saved me and saved my brothers. And I moved from being angry at them for putting the family in this relationship to being very grateful to them for their acts that really saved me in many different ways.
When you were a teenager, you came home one, I guess, evening and found your mother had tried to kill herself.
Often, yes. My mother often tried to commit suicide. And it took me a really long time to understand. I'm still learning that. And she would tell me, you see, we couldn't talk. Even inside the house, everything about our home was bugged. My parents' own bedroom was bugged. They would whisper in their own beds. Our phones were bugged. Often when I'm talking to a relative or friend, the palace operator, you know, disconnect, you know, or interfere and actually express their opinion sometimes.
They would butt into the conversation.
Seriously. Wow. Or tell me to get off the phone because the president's trying to reach my father or whatever it is. But there is definitely, you know, everything about us was exposed. We had a car, you know, in front of our house bugging us the whole time. And so my mother would say, I can feel the bars of the prison. I just cannot prove they exist to anybody. And it was that constant resistance because you are in a golden cage, you know, in a way. There was lots. I mean, I grew up in a very privileged household materially. And there was a suffocation. When he wanted us, it didn't matter where we are, what we felt, sick or tired or exams or no exams. We dropped everything and we reported to him to entertain him. And I grew up with seeing my mother's resistance and to that. And it's actually through her that I made it to America. It was she was a very strong woman in the meantime, and she would tell me that you always have to be strong and you always have to be independent and never let anybody touch you or talk with you the wrong way. And she always told me that you never learn how to cook and clean. No man should expect you to know that just because you're a woman, for example.
So that really makes your first marriage, in some ways it takes on a great dimension. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, so here's a strong woman, all of a sudden, at the age of 19, tells me, there's a marriage proposal you have in America. Please accept it. Which that was an arranged, you know, traditional marriage. And I'm like very confused. How could this strong, you know, mother tells me I have to be independent and strong, and then here she is trying to arrange a marriage for me. And she cried, and, you know, she's like, you have to go. You have to accept. Do whatever you want to do once you arrive, but you have to accept. And I did accept at the end of the day because I was a daughter who did not want to see her mother cry. And honestly, it was as simple as that, you know. And the marriage, unfortunately, was an abusive marriage. It was not a good marriage. It was a marriage that happened also in the midst of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. So when I left it 3 months afterwards, I could not even go home because Iraq was closed and the borders were closed and I could not reach my family. And I was upset at my mom for the longest time, even though I eventually remarried and wonderful marriage and all of that. But I was upset at my mom. I felt a betrayal of the person I loved the most. And it took really the process of her death through she had Lou Gehrig's disease about 11 years ago to tell me that this was her act of this was. Now, not in her own words, in mine, that this was her act of courage, that she needed to get me out of any costs, out of Saddam's sights, because I was becoming a woman and he was making remarks about me and she, as a mother, needed to get me out. The irony is that I work with other women in other war countries and I'm often offered their daughters. As a woman who lives in America, I'm often offered Afghan women's daughters, Congolese women's daughters who tell me, please take her. Maybe you'll give her a better life than I can. And it's ironic that I actually get offered the same thing in a way. That's what my mother did through the only choice she had, which was marriage. But in the process, I learned that my misfortunes have actually led to my fortunes. I would not have been here. I would not be starting Women for Women International and really living my truth in every single way if my mother did not bring me here.
During that time, your father was saying, Zainab, you don't have to do this if you don't want to. Do you think, I mean, obviously he wished that you had the choice. Do you think in some ways he didn't have the strength to lose you, even to the safety of the United States?
Well, we all lived in fear. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah. And so it was fear of upsetting Saddam. Mm-hmm. If I go, fear of upsetting. You know, marriage was the safest act. It was the only thing that Saddam could not object to. Mm-hmm. It was my parents' decision, traditionally.
Yeah.
Otherwise, every single aspect of my life was his. My friends, my schools, my cars, my everything about my life was under his control. The only thing my parents have exclusivity of is the marriage of their daughter. And so that was, I think, my dad always lived in that fear of upsetting him and sort of listening to my mother's determination that I needed to get out of Iraq.
What went through your head the day that the images emerged of him coming out of the spider hole and bedraggled and bearded and looking very weak?
I was in Jordan in that day, meeting with a group of Iraqi women to talk about the new Iraq and the new women's demands in Iraq and Iraq's constitution. And I remember most of the crowd, actually all of the crowd, were clapping and laughing. And I have to admit, I had tears in my eyes. And I was very conscious about them, actually, for two reasons. A, I never want to be someone who would celebrate someone else's humiliation. Mm-hmm. And even though I do not like Saddam, it was a humiliating moment. And second, I knew him as the devil and I knew him as uncle. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard two things to reconcile. But I knew him as both, and I see him as both.
Zainab Salbi is my guest. She's founder of the not-for-profit Women for Women International and author of Between Two Worlds and the Other Side of War. She's in town to address the Global Outreach Forum tomorrow night at AT&T Performing Arts Center. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is founder of the not-for-profit Women for Women International, Zainab Salbi. She's in town to address the Global Outreach Forum tomorrow night at the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Zainab, I know you have big success stories and very small, very personal success stories. Talk a little bit about Rwanda, because almost 50% of parliament now is made up of women?
53%.
Wow. Yes.
Well, Rwanda is an interesting case where progress started with women. Mm-hmm. So during the genocide in 1994, over 100 days, 500,000 women were raped and 800,000 people were killed by machetes mostly and some guns. So the country was, it collapsed, if you may. There were bodies in the streets. Dogs would pick up at humans' bodies, mm-hmm. literally. And then 70% of the population at that time was women, both because men escaped to Congo and because killed, you know, mm-hmm. mostly. And so the government made a very conscious decision that we need to invest in women. Now, I happened to have the opportunity to meet with the president of Rwanda several times. And every single time I meet him, I ask him, why did you invest in women? Because they literally went to the villages, asked women what they wanted, made sure to encourage them in their election, had a women-only election just to encourage their confidence, basically, and build it up. Eventually led to 53% of the parliament are women, 50% of the cabinet are women. Really one of the most amazing laws in the constitution for women, change inheritance laws, all of these things. And when you ask President Kagame, why is your investment in women? And he simply says, I'm not doing it only for women. I cannot rebuild this country that practically collapsed without having women fully included in it. It's simply the wisest decision that I have. And you have a very good case study because it's one of the most successful experiences in the world where women actually went from horrible atrocities 17 years ago, you know, to one of the most successful rates of women's participation in all sectors in the society. And that really shows, it shows few things. Leadership commitment to change is vital. And in this case, it was the president's commitment that this is important. B is if you give opportunities for women, they will rise up. Mm-hmm. They will not shy at all. Women end up in Rwanda doing very non-traditional jobs, from burying people, which is traditionally a man's task, to building homes. Women for Women International is building a center for women in one of our areas in Rwanda, and the women are making their own bricks. You know, that's usually a very male traditional job, and women are saying, we are making our own bricks to build our own centers. So they rose up once they were given the opportunities. And it just shows you that strong women actually do lead to strong nations. Rwanda is one of the cleanest, healthiest African countries at the moment. And a big thanks goes to women of Rwanda for that to happen.
So how do you apply the lessons of the success in Rwanda to a place like Afghanistan, where there is a great deal of anxiety right now over the planned withdrawal of U.S. and allied troops? Will the Taliban surge back in? You still only have a little over half of girls going to school. What do we do to make sure that whatever happens next contributes to growth and stability?
Very, very good question. Thank you for that. Afghanistan right now is in a critical, urgent point, or Afghan woman, because America and the allies did go to Afghanistan partially in the name of helping women. Not exclusively, but definitely the women line was held as part of the reason why we went. And we promised. And there were indeed a lot of progress. We have more women in the parliament of Afghanistan. We have more girls going to schools in Afghanistan. We do have more women engaged in different sectors in Afghanistan. There were promises, and women rose up to it just as in Rwanda. And now women feel a sense of fear that they may be abandoned. Mm-hmm. I was in Afghanistan last summer, and lots of women, to be honest, the ones who are educated and in the parliament and all of that, were furious. Were saying, you promised us, you came, yes, you did give us an opportunity, and we rose up and took it. And now there are negotiations with the Taliban that is happening, and women are one of the line items in the agenda of negotiations.
So it could go either way, essentially.
Well, actually, a formal advisor informally told me, to the negotiation, told me women will have to pay a price. They will have to compromise in their attire and in their mobility, but we just have to do it. And it is a very good example of sacrificing women, or on the edge of sacrificing women, for what we believe could be the larger peace, and we need to have to withdraw and all of these things. But the historical arguments and historical facts and records shows always when we sacrifice women, it just starts with women. Mm-hmm. That you actually, it's not the end of the story. It's just really simply the beginning of the story. So we're in a very, very critical stage in Afghanistan of are we going to close our eyes and ears and mouth and say, let's just the negotiation happen so we can withdraw? Or are we going to really be able to look at ourselves in the mirror and say, we stood up for Afghan women 100%? And, you know, this March 8th is the 100th year anniversary of International Women's Day. And Women for Women International is having a pledge for all American women, particularly, to please join us to sign and share that this is important, that we cannot sacrifice, or we cannot live in an era where America is part of witnessing the sacrifice of Afghan women in the negotiations between the Taliban and the Afghan government without doing anything about it. We do need to make sure, not necessarily to protect Afghan women on their behalf, we just need to make sure that women are included at the negotiating table. They know what they want. They're very clear about it. We just need to make sure that they have their space to express their voices.
Is there a way from where we sit politically in the United States to compel Afghanistan to allow women a formal role in rebuilding and in shaping policy moving forward?
I think there's way, definitely. I mean, first of all, they are already there.
Yeah.
You know, it's about compromising what they've accomplished or not. But America has a huge power in Afghanistan and on many levels. One is we have the financial power.
Mm-hmm.
America is still one of the biggest investors in terms of aid to Afghanistan and to Pakistan, a neighboring country that is seen as a major ally to America in whatever negotiation or agreement that we can land on in Afghanistan. So that's one issue. So how do we use this financial leverage to ensure that both countries are protecting women in the process of their nation building, you know? So that's one. Of course, America has a huge military and political power over there. And frankly, it's a political will issue. You know, it's a political will. Does America have a say in Afghanistan and Pakistan? You bet, in every single way. Do we have the political will? It is yet to be seen in terms of how do we go about ending our role in Afghanistan while preserving women's rights. When I was there, I was in one of Women for Women International Center, and I met a woman who was promised to be married at the age of 6, was married at the age of 15, became a widow at the age of 16, and a single mother. And she said during the Taliban. And she said she was very, very, very poor. And one day she was forced to go out in the street and sell hats. And the Taliban found her. And she said, I owned only one pair of shoes. And when they found me, they took that one pair of shoes that I was wearing and they beat me up with it and they broke it. And I wasn't sure when she was talking whether she got hurt more that she was beaten up by them or that they broke her only one pair of shoes. And she said, I was just broken for the longest time. And then things change. You know, the Taliban were overthrown. Things change. She talks about how she's sending her daughter to school right now, how she returned to school. She went through Women for Women International's program, and now she's earning $400 a month, both teaching women embroideries and selling her own material. And she wants to go to college. And I listened to her, knowing in the background that she's being negotiated away, that what she's accomplished, standing upright back on her feet, and her hopes for her daughter, and what her belief and her hopes for herself may actually be all compromised in the name of peace. And I don't understand how we can have peace when 50% of the population's rights could be compromised.
We have an email here from Mary Kate who writes, I love hearing from an Iraqi woman with such a strong sense of self. It helps round out my own idea of Arabic women as I often see them as silent and hiding behind special clothing. She's the opposite of that view. Also, I'm a veteran who served in Mosul, Iraq, and I think that as a woman and a veteran, her organization is one which would allow me to give back to that country as well as other countries experiencing war in a positive way.
Well, thank you very much. This is very, very kind and very sweet of you. And I appreciate your generosity. You know, I think, I think you're right in general that there's a lot of silence among women at large, I would say. You know, I learned in the process. First, I thought it's only women in war. Then I thought it's only marginalized women who go into domestic violence and all of that. Then I learned it actually happens throughout all socioeconomic backgrounds, mm-hmm. in all of the worlds. And still one out of four women in the world are facing some kind of violence, you know. So that's one thing. And that obviously applies to my own home country, Iraq. But it applies to my own country now, America. You know, it's in different extents.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, women are are not fully equal yet, but the extent of discrimination and marginalization is severely different, you know, from one country to another. But the core of the principle of the issue is still not fully addressed. But I also think that women break their silence in different ways, and we are witnessing an era where women are breaking their silence. If you go to the email, and particularly to vis-a-vis Arab women, for example, most Muslim women are breaking their silence through fictions and non-fictions. Mm-hmm. It's almost, I call it a subtle way. It's under the bridge way of reaching out to other parts of the world, using fiction and novels and literature as a way to reach out, because it's a safer way to do that. If you look at Women for Women's International's program, actually, the letter exchange between a sponsor in America and a sponsored woman in different country, in Iraq, for example, is another way of breaking silence. A few years ago, I go to Iraq all the times, but a few years ago I was in Iraq in the midst of tension between of fighting and all of that. And an Iraqi woman, she brought up the letter from her American sister, mm-hmm, through Women for Women International program. And she said, I spray rose water on that letter. Rose water for us is holy water. You put it on the Quran and the Bible, and it's really to preserve holy things. And she says, I love this woman. I preserve this letter she wrote me, you know, under my pillow every day. And I said, well, how do you feel that she's American? You know, I mean, mm-hmm, how do you feel about it? You know, she says, I love her. She is saving me. She's saving my family. And I don't care which country she's from, what religion she has. She is my sister. That's what I call building bridges between women, and how women are breaking their silence is in these subtle ways, in through letter exchange or through novels and fictions, breaking up. And so how do breaking their silence? So the question becomes, how do we echo their voices? How do we make the whole world hearing it? And we do that in many ways. I know at Women Forum International on March 8th, we're appealing for all women to meet on a bridge in their own community, country, whatever, to echo the voices of women whose voices we may not hear very loud and very clear.
Including here in North Texas, I should say.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Just go to womenforwomen.org and you'll find the details of how you can organize your own bridge meeting. And last year we had women in 118 cities, 20 countries gathering people from Congo and Rwanda, Bosnia and Serbia, meeting together and tying their fabrics together and saying enough is enough with these wars, and we are demanding peace, and now we're having the audacity to express and articulate what we mean by peace, and that's what we want. And so it's how do we echo each other's voices for the whole world to listen to what's happening to women?
Are women convincing men in greater numbers of the importance of this?
I think we are actually in a turning point in history in that. And that turning point actually, interestingly, started through the financial institutions. So, you know, those of us who are in the women's movement, if you may, we have lots of research and data and records to show really the importance of investment in women, mm-hmm, you know. But suddenly, a few years ago, Goldman Sachs research department came up with a correlation between, particularly on Japan, between women's economic contribution or being economically active in Japan's economy and the economic growth of that country. Hmm. And so it came out of their research department, and they started doing more research, and they started looking from Japan to Cameroon to different parts of the world. And they realized that actually women are the future indicators for economic growth. And that by itself attracted more men to be part of supporting women and investing in women's economic opportunities and educational opportunities as a way for the future growth of economies.
I guess whatever works. Thank you so much. Zainab Salbi is founder and president of Women for Women International. We have a link to their site on the think page of KERA.org. It really was wonderful to have you this hour.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.